If you look around you, there's evidence of identity politics everywhere you look, from the appointment of the latest Governor General of Australia, a noted champion of quotas and gender-based activism, to relentless news items or LinkedIn posts which make statements of identity before they make statements of opinion or fact. It feels like a whole generation is bickering about the labels to which they adhere. Need I even mention pronouns? These labels are, of course, supposed to help people find community. But is there a downside to these otherwise good intentions? And how has identity politics been conflated with social justice? Yasha Monk is a professor of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Affairs, and he's the author of the book The Identity Trap, A Story of Ideas and Power in Our Time. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
You begin this book by proposing a new term to identify or define identity politics because, and I quote, "Nowadays, anyone who talks about identity politics or describes an activist as woke is liable to be perceived as an old man yelling at the clouds." An undeniable Simpsons reference, in my view. Anyway, I wanted to ask, how is identity synthesis, your term, similar but different to identity politics?
Yeah, so I think the problem with the term identity politics is that it's just too broad. It comprises too many different kinds of things. When I think of some of my political heroes, you could describe them in certain sense as engaging in identity politics. People like Frederick Douglass, who fought for the emancipation of slaves in the United States, or the people fighting for the equality of gays and lesbians over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. The difference is that they wanted to fight for inclusion under a set of universal principles that would apply to everybody. They said, in the American context, you talk about all men being created equal. Well, how can you exclude Black people from equality in such a terrible, violent way? They said, you know, you talk about the importance of love and committed relationships. Well, why are you excluding people who happen to have a same-sex partner from the same kinds of protections? What really defines the new form of identity politics that has become so dominant, what I call the identity synthesis, is a vision of society in which how we interact, how the state should treat all of us, how we think of ourselves should fundamentally depend on the kind of racial and gender categories, on the kind of sexual orientation into which we are born. And it is that specific ideology which has become so powerful in the last decades that is, I think, a mistake and that I call identity synthesis.
So if using and leaning into identity labels is a trap, even when the intention is positive, do we get this sort of complete 360 where the idea of inclusion is actually non-inclusion?
Well, I think inclusion is a very good thing, but to be truly included, you need to be treated as an equal. And to be treated as an equal means that the way in which I interact with you, the way in which various institutions treat you, does not turn in every respect on the kind of group into which you are born. So I think it is a debate about what it would mean to have true inclusion. And so I think that at the moment we see these two real traps in this new ideology. That's why I called my book The Identity Trap. The first is at the personal level. I see many of my students, for example, have been encouraged by the teachers in high school, and middle school, and elementary school to really define themselves by the group into which they are born. And the idea is that that will somehow help them to be treated as unique little snowflakes, as critics sometimes say. Now, I actually think that we are all unique little snowflakes. I think we're all distinct from each other in a wonderful way. But that's not defined just by the particular intersection of identities at which we stand. I have a similar set of identities to my brother. But if society sees me in identical terms to my brother, that's not going to allow me to feel truly seen and appreciated by society. And the second trap is more political. It's that, as you mentioned, in the Australian context, there's quotas in every context. In the American context, during the pandemic, the United States did not follow the example of other countries in prioritizing elderly people for COVID vaccines, because the CDC pointed out that older Americans are disproportionately white. That is encouraging a zero-sum conflict between different identity groups, between different ethnic blocs, who are saying, well, if we want to get our own, we need to fight for the interests of our group against those other groups. And that is not going to lead to a more harmonious or to a more inclusive society.
This idea between identity synthesis, as you call it, and a new kind of social class system is interesting, because I think most people would try to express some sort of freedom, mobility between identities and classes. You mentioned being born into, but we're talking about some identities which you might say are more of a choice. So talk to me about this idea of an emerging or new social class system as a result of this kind of thinking.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that we need to have a double freedom in diverse societies like Australia or the United States or most countries in Europe today. We have to have a freedom to define ourselves in some ways by the groups to which we belong, by saying, for example, that your religion is important to you and you mostly want to be surrounded by fellow believers, by people who share the same kind of creed. That is part of a freedom of association that we have in a free, in a liberal society. But you also have to be free not to be defined completely by the kind of group to which you belong. You have to be free to go out and make connections with people who might be very much unlike you, to say that the most important thing about you is not the color of your skin or who you're romantically interested in, but your professional pursuits or your personal qualities. And I worry very much that in many contexts, we are given up on that double freedom. When I see, for example, teachers in many schools, particularly in the United States, but in other countries too, come into classrooms when kids are 8 or 7 or 6 years old and say, the white kids are going to go into one classroom and the black kids into another classroom and the kids with roots in Asia into a third classroom, the kids who are Latino into a fourth classroom. And we're going to teach them that the most important thing about themselves is the racial identity, that that is how they should perceive themselves. That is not somebody choosing what they value, how they define themselves, what goes to the core of a being. This is teachers in a misguided attempt at thinking that this will somehow make us help us make political progress, imposing on these children how they should see themselves.
If you've just joined me on RN Drive, I'm speaking with Yasha Monk. He's the author of The Identity Trap. We're talking about issues, I suppose, to do with identity politics, or as he calls it, identity synthesis. The idea of categorization is an interesting one because it's infinite. You know, this aspect or obsession with dividing us into labels of race or gender locks out those who cross the divide between multiple categories, if you like. So if you're biracial, I wonder if there's that class in the elementary school for you. Where does it end? Where does all this division and categorization actually end? Because it seems like the minorities will only become smaller.
Well, this is exactly one of the concerns I have about making these relatively simplistic identity categories so central to our social and political life. A friend of mine, Coleman Hughes, recounts that on his first day at Columbia University in New York, he was asked to participate in this kind of affinity group exercise. And it so happens that Coleman's father is black and Coleman's mother is Puerto Rican. And so he had to choose on his first day of his higher education between the identity of his father and his mother. That is not the kind of situation into which institutions should be putting the members. And so to me, a society that revolves around this form of identity politics is going to lead to this constant conflict. It's going to make us lean into our evolutionary instinct to say, I'm going to treat the members of my group with great altruism and sometimes courage. But if you belong to another group, then I really don't owe you anything at all. And there's thankfully a much better alternative, an alternative in which we recognize the injustices that have historically shaped our countries, that certainly persist to a significant extent, but in which we also see where we've been able to make tremendous progress towards building more just societies by doing our best to live up to the universal principles that motivated them. The principle that we should treat all citizens equally, irrespective of their skin color or religion or their sexual orientation. That has allowed us to overcome extreme discrimination against sexual minorities, extreme racism in our societies, to make genuine progress towards a more inclusive society. That progress is not complete, but when we recognize that we've been able to move towards a better society, we should also become more confident about continuing to make progress in the same direction by redoubling our efforts to live up to those fundamental principles of our society. What the advocates of the identity trap want to do is the opposite. They say, because we've supposedly not made any progress towards a more just society, we have to rip up fundamental principles of liberal democracy root and branch, and we have to institute a new set of rules which conceive of society not as a collection of citizens who see each other as compatriots, but as a small collection of rival tribes that have to be appeased and that will always be in hostile negotiation with each other.
I'm curious about what other antidotes you might have to this sort of thinking. You know, I think about how, a generation of young people, particularly in this country right now, feel locked out of the housing market. They feel like the system's not working for them. This idea that there's no point conserving that status quo if it's not working for you. So, and the other thing is, if you say to young people, particularly those who are very passionate about their identities, whatever they might be, that you can't be that, or you shouldn't be that, or that's not important. You've got to realize there are other things more important than you. This is sort of radioactive argument in this kind of discussion. So coming back to those antidotes, how do you show people, particularly young people, but people more generally, what's at stake if this kind of circular spiral of identity politics thinking continues?
Well, first of all, let me just point out that there's absolutely no sociological evidence that these kinds of ideas are especially widespread among ethnic minorities. And there's also quite clear evidence that for them, maybe a little bit more common among young people, most young people reject these ideas as well. So in one striking American study, for example, the group of what the study called progressive activists, broadly speaking, people who we might describe as quote unquote woke, were actually disproportionately likely to be white, disproportionately likely to be very affluent, and hugely disproportionately likely to be extremely highly educated. So this is
not very inclusive.
Yes, so this is not the ideology of the deeply marginalized in society. It's the ideology of people who went to fancy universities. And, I teach at a fancy university. I have a lot of love and sympathy for that world. But we should be realistic about who it is who is pushing forward these ideas.
So who is? Because in your book, you speak about these kind of tropes or approaches coming out of universities, perhaps some corporations as well. Who is responsible for these sorts of teachings, if you like?
Well, again, I mean, this study seems to suggest that it's people who are disproportionately white, disproportionately affluent, and disproportionately highly educated, which is to say people in elite circles, people who live in the big metropolitan centers, people who have a university education, who probably live, have a job in the knowledge economy, people who are, as the language of his ideology would put it, comparatively privileged. And that may have something to do with the overstatement of the problems of countries that can go along with this ideology, the catastrophizing, but somehow the challenges faced by this generation are so much worse, so much incomparably harder than those of previous generations. I mean, Australia is a country that certainly has challenges, including the housing market that you pointed out, but that is also vastly richer than it was 25 years ago or 50 years ago, and certainly much more diverse and inclusive than it was 25 or 50 years ago. When you look at countries that don't embrace some of the basic principles of liberal democracy around the world, the kind of threat that people face to their safety and their prosperity, but also to their ability to speak their minds, to organize politically, is incomparably greater. So I do think that a realistic appraisal of the shortcomings and challenges of our societies, but also of the great achievements, is one important step in the right direction. And here again, I think that most young people actually understand that. But there's certainly a vocal cohort of young people who think that everything is terrible. But I'd be very surprised if the average 20-year-old to 25-year-old Australian thinks that the country is the worst in the world, and that everything was better in the past.
Marvelous to talk to you today. My guest has been Yasha Monk. He's the political scientist and author of The Identity Trap, A Story of Ideas and Power in Our Time, which is out now. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.